One Eye stopped nodding off long enough to clap his hands lazily.
"Tear 'em up, little girl, tear 'em up!"
"Sarky old reprobate." One Eye snickered. Goblin said,
"You want another angle? Find out from your library pals who makes bound blank books. Go to them and find out who's ordered some recently. Or bribe them to let you know when anybody does."
"Gosh," I said, "somebody who actually uses his brain to think. The delight of the world is that its wonders never cease. Where the devil did Mergen go?" Sara said, "You just told him to find Narayan Singh and the Daughter of Night." "I didn't mean right this second. I wanted to know if he found out anything about Chandra Gokhale we can use."
"Pressure getting to you, little girl."
One Eye's tone was so sweet I wanted to pop him.
"Relax. Now's the time when you don't want to force anything."
A couple of men from the duty crew, Run Must Sing and the Shadowlander dubbed Kindo Cutter by his squad mates, invited themselves into the staff meeting. Kindo reported,
"There's all kinds of screaming going on out there tonight. I sent out word everybody should hole up someplace where there's plenty of light."
Sara said, "The shadows are hunting." I said, "We'll be all right here. But just to be safe, Goblin, why don't you make the rounds with Kindo and Runmust? We don't want any surprises." "Sara, will Soulcatcher let the shadows run completely wild?"
"To make her point?
You're the analyst. What do the books say about her?"
"They say she's capable of anything. She has no connection with the humanity of anyone else. It must be very lonely to be her."
"What?"
"We agree our next target should be Chandra Gokhale?"
Sara eyed me oddly. That had been decided already, unless some better opportunity fell into our laps. We would eliminate the Inspector General, without whom the tax system and the bureaucratic side of government would stumble and stagger. He also seemed the most vulnerable of our enemies, and his removal would leave the Radisha more isolated than ever, cut off by the Protector on one hand, the priests on the other, and unable to turn anywhere because she was the Radisha, the princess, unapproachable, in some respects a demigoddess. It had to be lonely to be her, too. Subtlety and finesse. I asked, "What did we do today to frighten the world?" Then I realized that I knew the answer. It had been part of the plan for capturing Swan. All the Brotherhood would have avoided any risks. Tonight, there would be shows from buttons previously planted. There would be more again tomorrow night. Smoke and light shows proclaiming, "Water sleeps," or "My brother unforgiven," or "All their days are numbered." There would be more, somewhere, every evening from now on. Sara mused, "Someone who wasn't one of us brought in another prayer wheel and mounted it on a memorial post outside the north entrance. It hadn't been noticed yet when I left."
"Same message?"
"I presume."
"That's scary.
That could be a potent one."
"Rajadharma."
"It has the Radisha thinking already. That monk burning himself definitely got our attention."
Story of my life. Here I spend months working out every tiny detail of a marvelous plan, and I get upstaged by a lunatic with a fire fetish.
"So those Bodhi nuts found a good message. You think we could steal some of their thunder?"
One Eye chuckled evilly. "What?" I demanded.
"Sometimes I amaze myself."
Goblin, about to leave with Runmust and Kindo, observed,
"You've been amazed at yourself for 200 years. Mainly 'cause nobody else bothers to get interested in insects."
"You better not go to sleep any time soon, Frog Face."
"Gentlemen?"
Sara said, gently. Yet she grabbed the attention of both wizards.
"Can we stick to business? I need some sleep."
"Absolutely,"
Goblin said,
Absolutely. If the old fart has an idea, let's get it out here before it dies of loneliness. You may continue your assignment.
Goblin stuck out his tongue but left. Amaze the rest of us, One-Eye, I suggested. I did not want him dozing off before he shared his wisdom.
Next time one of those bodhi loons lights himself up, we have the smoke and flames carry our message. Water sleeps, and a new one I thunk up, nor even death destroy. You got to admit, that's got a nice religious ring to it.
Indeed, I agreed. What the heck does it mean?
Little girl, don't you start in on me.
The ghost of evil's past whispered.
I found them.
Mergen was back. I did not ask who. Where?
The thieves' garden.
Shor Bagan? The Greys have it under siege. And they were still serious about getting the place cleaned out, Mergen said. Chapter 17. Sorrow wakened me well before dawn, which is not my best time of day. When I opted for a military career, we were besieged in my hometown. I just knew that once we got out of here, we would sleep till noon. We would eat fresh food all the time, and there would be plenty of it, and never, ever would we have to go out in the rain again. In the meantime, I took the best I could get, which was the Black Company during the siege, with the water 50 feet deep. The only thing resembling fresh food was the long pig Mogaba and his gnar friends were enjoying, unless you counted the occasional lame rat or slow-witted crow.
What? I grumbled.
Personally, I am convinced that even the priests of happy-go-lucky old Gangisha are not required to be pleasant before an hour much closer to noon than this was.
I have to go to the palace. You have to appear at the library. If we want to snatch Narion and the girl right in front of the Greys, we need to start planning right now.
She was right. But that did not mean I had to accept it gracefully. Every company member inside Do Trang's complex and Bon himself gathered over a crude breakfast. Only Tobo and Mother Goda were absent. But they would have no part in any of this, I thought. Nobody from outside could be included now, because shadows were on the prowl.
We got a plan all worked out,
One Eye announced proudly.
I'm sure it's one stroke of genius after another,
I replied as I made a groggy effort to collect a bowl of cold rice, a mango, and a bowl of tea.
First thing, Goblin goes up there in his dervish outfit. Then Tobo comes strutting along.
Good morning, Adu,
I murmured distractedly as the gateman admitted me to the library grounds. I was worried about leaving Goblin and One-Eye to operate on their own. My mother instinct at work, they said, both showing nasty teeth as they reminded me that every hen has to trust her chicks on their own sometime. A point well made. Though few hens have to worry about their chicks getting drunk, forgetting what they are doing, and wandering off in search of adventure in a city where there is not even one other skinny little black man or ugly little white character. Adu nodded his greeting. He never had anything to say. Inside the library, I went to work immediately, though only a couple of copyists had arrived before me. Sometimes Doraby focused as intently as Sawa did. That helped turn off the worries.
Doraby? Doraby de Banerjee?
I started awake, amazed that I had fallen asleep. I had squatted down on my heels in a corner, in a fashion common amongst Guni and Yuang Bo, but not common among Vedna, Shadar, or many of the ethnic minorities. We Vedna favor sitting on the floor or on a cushion cross-legged. Shadar like low chairs or stools. Not owning at least a crude stool is the truest mark of poverty among the Shadar. I was in character even in my sleep.
Master Santaraxita?
Are you ill?
He sounded concerned.
Tired. I didn't sleep well. The Skildirsha were hunting last night.
I used the Shadowlander name for the shadows. That did not trouble Sentaraxita. It had become part of the language under the Protectorate.
The screams kept waking me up.
I understand. I did not enjoy a sound sleep myself, though not for that reason. I was unaware of the horror till I saw its marks this morning.
The Skildirsha show a proper respect for the priestly clan, then?
The faintest twitch of his lip told me he had not missed the joke.
I am properly appalled, Doraby. This is evil unlike any we have ever known. The blind misfortune of flood or plague or disaster we must endure stoically. And against the darkness even the gods themselves sometimes contend in vain. But to send out a pack of these shadows to do murder randomly and often, and for no reason even an insane man can comprehend. That is evil of the sort the Northerners used to preach.
Doraby managed a credible job of looking slack-jawed.
I'm sorry. I'm exercised. You probably never saw any of the outsiders.
He placed the same stress on outsiders that many Taglians used when they meant the Black Company specifically.
I did. I saw the Liberator himself once when I was little. And I saw the one they called the Lieutenant after she came back from Dejagore. I was pretty far away, but I remember it because that was the same day she killed all the priests and the Protector. I saw her a couple of times.
I was making it up as I went, but that was the sort of thing most adult Taglians could claim. The company had been in and out of the city for years before the final campaign against Long Shadow and the Fortress Overlook. I rose.
I'll get back to work now.
You do your job well, Doraby.
Thank you, Master Sentaraxita. I try.
Indeed.
He seemed to be having trouble getting something out.
I have decided that you will be allowed access to any books not in the restricted section.
Restricted books were those not available in multiple copies. Only the most favored scholars were allowed near those. So far, I had been able to determine only a handful of the titles of the books so set aside.
When you have no other obligations.
Part of my day, every day, I spent just waiting to be told about something I needed to do.
Thank you, Master Sentaraxita.
I'll expect you to be able to discuss them.
Yes, Master Sentaraxita.
We have set our feet upon an unknown road, Doraby. An exciting and frightening journey lies ahead.
His prejudices were such that he actually meant what he said. Me reading had twisted his universe all out of shape, and now he was going to conspire in this perverted vermiculation. I took my broom in hand. Exciting and frightening things would be happening elsewhere in my universe, and I hated every second that I was not there to control them. Chapter 18. The little dervish in brown wool seemed completely lost inside himself. He was busy talking to himself, paying no attention to the surrounding world. Most likely he was quoting to himself from the sacred texts of the Vedna, as understood by his peculiar splinter sect. Though tired and irritable, the Greys did not challenge him immediately. They had been taught to honor all holy men, not just those already secure within the Shadar truths. Any devoted stalker after wisdom would find his path leading him to enlightenment eventually. Tolerance of such seekers was common to all Taglians. The welfare of the soul and the spirit were of grave concern to most. The Guni, indeed, considered the seeking of enlightenment to be one of the four key stages of an ideally lived life. Once a man successfully raised up and provided for his children, he should put all things material, all ambition and pleasure aside. He should go into a forest to live as a hermit or become a mendicant seeker, or in some other way should live out his final years looking for the truth and purifying his soul. Many of the greatest names in Taglian and Southern history are those of kings and rich men who chose just such a path. But human nature being human nature... The Greys did not, however, let the dervish follow his quest into Chor Bagan. A sergeant intercepted him. His associates surrounded the holy man. The sergeant said,
"Father, you cannot go in that direction. This street has been closed to traffic by order of Minister Swan."
Even dead, Swan had to take the blame for Soulcatcher's policies. The dervish apparently failed to notice the Greys till he actually collided with the sergeant.
"Huh?"
The younger Greys laughed. Men enjoy seeing their prejudices confirmed. The sergeant repeated his message. He added,
"You must turn right or left. We're rooting out the evils infesting what lies straight ahead."
He possessed a touch of wit. The dervish looked first right, then left. He shivered, then announced,
"All evil is the result of metaphysical error,"
in a raspy little voice, and started along the street to the right. It was a very strange street. It was almost empty of humanity. In Taglios, that was something seldom seen. A moment later, the Shadar sergeant squealed in surprise and pain. He began slapping his side.
"What's the matter?"
another Grey asked.
"Something bit me,"
he squealed again, which indicated that he was in a great deal of agony, for Shadar were proud of their ability to endure pain without outcry or even flinching. Two of the sergeant's men tried to lift his shirt, while a third clung to his arm in an effort to keep him immobile. He shrieked again. Smoke began to boil out of his side. The Greys were so startled they backed away. The sergeant went down. He went into convulsions. Smoke continued to boil up. It assumed a form none of the Greys wanted to see.
"Niasi!"
The demon Niasi began to whisper secrets no Shadar wanted to hear. Grinning to himself, Goblin slipped into Chor Bagan. He disappeared long before anyone wondered if there might not be a connection between the sergeant's discomfort and the Vaidine dervish. Greys arrived from all directions. Officers barked and cursed and drove them back to their stations before the denizens of Chor Bagan seized the opportunity to escape. Obviously, this was a distraction meant to give their prey the chance to run. A crowd had begun to gather, too. Among them was a Nuangbo boy who picked his moment, cut a purse, and fled past the Greys, one of whom recalled him from the evening when one of their own got stoned. Discipline began to collapse. The Grey officers tried, and managed rather well, considering. Only a few people escaped Chor Bagan, and a half dozen slipped inside, among them a skinny little old man in the all-enveloping yellow of a leper. One Eye was not pleased. He was sure strategy had had nothing to do with it being him who had to assume the yellow. Goblin was up to something wicked. The six raiders approached the target tenement from front and rear in loose teams of three. One Eye was around front. People cleared off fast when they saw the yellow. Lepers were held in absolute terror. None of the men wanted to carry out a raid in broad daylight. It was not the company way. But darkness was denied us till Soulcatcher pulled her shadows back off the streets, and the consensus of the analysts and wizards was that it was less likely that the Daughter of Night could summon Kina's help during daylight. Daytime also offered a better chance of taking her by surprise. Each team paused to make sure every man still wore his yarn bracelet before they stormed into the tenement. Each wizard set loose an array of previously prepared low-grade confusion spells that buzzed through the ramshackle structure like a swarm of drunken mosquitoes. The attackers passed inside, stepping over and around frightened, shivering families who, till now, had considered themselves wildly fortunate to have a roof over their heads, even if that meant renting floor space in a hallway. Both teams posted a man who would make sure no one went outside. Another two men met at the foot of the rickety stair. They would prevent movement up or down. Goblin and One Eye met at the cellar entrance and shared a few complaints about being desperately undermanned. Then a few exaggerated courtesies as each offered the other the opportunity to go down into the enemy's den first. Goblin finally accepted on the basis of superior youth, quickness, and alleged intelligence. He launched a couple of luminary floating stars into the pit, where the darkness was blacker than Kina's heart.
"Here," Goblin said. "Ha! We've got..."
Something like a flaming tiger burst out of nowhere. It leaped at Goblin. A shadow drifted in from the side. It flicked something long and thin that looped around the little wizard's neck. One Eye's cane came down on Narion's wrist, hard enough to crack bone. The living saint of the Strangler lost his rumal, which flew across the cellar. One Eye's offhand tossed something over Goblin's head toward the source of the tiger. A ghostly light floated up like a wisp of luminescent swamp gas. It moved, suddenly enveloping a young woman. She began to slap at herself, trying to wipe it off. Goblin did something quick, while she was distracted. She collapsed.
"Goddamn, goddamn! It worked! I'm a genius! Admit it, I'm a fucking genius!"
"Who's a genius? Who came up with the plan?"
"Plan? What plan? Success is in the details, runt. Who came up with the details? Any damn fool could have said, 'Let's go catch them two.'"
Both men tied limbs as they nattered. One Eye said,
"Plan the details on this. We got to get out of here with these people, through all the greys in the world."
"Already covered. They've got so much trouble, they won't have time to worry about any damned lepers."
He started trying to get a yellow outfit over the head of the Daughter of Night.
"Remind me to warn them back at the shop that this one can put together an illusion or two."
"I know that's the way it's supposed to go."
One Eye began dragging Narion Singh into another yellow outfit. In a moment, Goblin would trade his brown for yellow, too. Upstairs, the four company brothers, all of Shadar origin, were turning themselves into greys.
"I'm saying it ain't got a prayer of working."
"That's because I planned it?"
"Absolutely. You're beginning to catch on. Welcome to reality."
"It goes to shit in your hands. You can blame it on Sleepy, not me. It was her idea."
"We got to do something about that girl. She thinks too damned much. Will you quit farting around? Them goddamn greys out there are going to have time to go home for lunch."
"Don't hit him so hard. You want him to walk out of here under his own power."
"You talking to me? What the hell are you doing with... Get your hand out of there, you old pervert."
"I'm putting a control amulet over her heart, you dried up old turd, so she won't embarrass us before we get her home."
"Oh, yeah, sure you are. But why don't I look on the bright side? At least you're interested in girls again."
"She built as nice as her mother."
"Better."
"Watch your mouth. The place might be haunted, and I got a suspicion maybe some of those ghosts can talk to each other, no matter what Murgan claims."
One Eye began to bully the groggy Narion Singh up the steps.
"I do believe this is going to work,"
One Eye crowed. The combination of greys and lepers seemed the perfect device for exiting the thieves' garden, particularly now that the real greys were running around distracted.
"I don't want to break your heart, old-timer," Goblin said, "but I think we done been fished."
He was looking over his shoulder. One Eye looked back.
"Shite!"
A small flying carpet dropped toward them, accompanied by crows making no sounds at all. Soul Catcher and her very stance suggested mischievous glee. She threw something.
"Spread out!" Goblin barked. "Don't let those two get away!"
He faced the descending carpet, heart in his throat. If it came to a direct face-off, he was going to get splattered like a stomped egg. He extended a gloved hand, caught the falling black globule, whipped his arm in a circle and launched the missile back into the sky. Soulcatcher shrieked, outraged. The people of Taglios did not have that kind of nerve. She drove the carpet to one side, avoiding the black globe. And well she moved when she did. Her luck had served her yet again. A screaming fireball ripped right through the space she had vacated. The same kind of fireball that had eaten all those holes in the palace wall and had set the bodies of so many men burning like bad fat candles. She continued to dive. Two more fireballs barely missed her. She put a tenement between herself and the sharpshooters. She was extremely angry, but did not let rage cloud her thinking. Above her, her crows began bursting like soundless fireworks. Blood, flesh, and feathers rained down. In seconds, she figured it out, conversing with herself and a committee of voices. They had not been hiding inside Chorbagan after all. She could not have caught anyone trying to slip away like this if they had not come in to retrieve something they did not want found.
"They're here in the city."
"But we haven't found them!
We haven't seen a trace or heard a rumor that they didn't want to reach our ears until now."
"That takes wizardry, that bold little one."
"That was the Toad Man."
"Goblin."
"Though the great general of the armies, Mogaba, assures us that he saw the body himself."
"Who else is alive?
Could the great general himself be less trustworthy than he would like us to believe?" That was not possible. Mogaba had no other friends. He was committed in perpetuity. Soulcatcher brought her carpet to earth, stepped off, folded its light bamboo frame, rolled the carpet around that, surveyed the street. They had come down this way, from up there. What could they have wanted desperately enough to have exposed themselves so thoroughly? Anything they thought that important would be something she was bound to find very interesting herself. It took just one whispered word of power to illuminate the cellar. The squalor was appalling. Soulcatcher turned slowly. A man and his daughter, apparently. An old man and a young woman, anyway. One lamp, discarded clothing, a few handfuls of rice, some fish meal. Why the writing instruments and ink? What was this? A book. Somebody had just begun writing in it in an unfamiliar alphabet. She caught a spot of black movement in the corner of her eye. She whirled, crouching, fearing an attack by a rogue shadow. The Skildirsha maintained an especially potent hatred for those who dared command them. A rat fled, dropping the object of its curiosity. Soulcatcher knelt, picked up a long strip of black silk with an antique silver coin sewn into one corner.
"Oh, I see."
She began to laugh like a young girl, catching on late to the meaning of an off-color joke. She collected the book, surveyed the scene once more before leaving.
"Dedication sure doesn't pay."
Once in the street again, she reassembled her carpet, unconcerned about snipers. Those people would be long gone and far away. They knew their business, but crows should be tracking them. She froze, staring upward, but not really seeing the white crow on the peak of the tenement roof.
"How did they find out where those two were?"
Chapter 19.
"What happened?"
Sarah demanded, as soon as she came in, before she began shedding me and Subradil's rags. I was still Dorby Day Bannerjai myself. "We lost Mergen somehow. Goblin thought they had him anchored, but he went away while we were all out, and I don't know how to get him back."
"I meant what happened in the Thieves' Garden. Soulcatcher was out there. Whatever she tried to pull didn't work out, but she came back a different person. I didn't get to hear everything she told the Radisha. But I do know she found something or figured out something that changed her whole attitude. Like everything suddenly stopped being fun. I said, "Oh, I don't know. Maybe Mergen can tell us, if we can get him back here." Goblin joined us. He was pushing a sleeping one eye in Bondo Trang's spare wheelchair. He announced, "They're resting peacefully. Drugged. Narion was distraught. The girl took it pretty calmly. We need to worry about her." "What's wrong with him?" I asked, indicating one eye. "He's worn out. He's an old man. I want to see you have half the energy he does when you get to be half his age." Sarah asked, "Why do we need to worry about the girl?" "Because she's her mother's daughter. She doesn't have much skill with it yet, because she hasn't had anybody to teach her, but she's got the natural ability to become a substantial sorceress, maybe even as powerful as her mother, but without Lady's rudimentary sense of ethics. It reeks off her."
"'Tain't the only thing she reeks of, neither,"
One-Eye chirped.
"First thing you do with that little honey, you throw her in a vat of hot water, then throw in a couple 4 lumps of lye soap and let her soak for a week."
Sarah and I exchanged glances. If she was bad enough to offend One-Eye, she had to be ripe indeed. Goblin grinned from ear to ear, but eschewed temptation. I said, "I hear you ran into the Protector."
"She was on a roof or somewhere, waiting for something to happen. She didn't get what she expected, a couple of fireballs, and she ducked and stayed ducked."
"You made it home without being followed?" I knew the answer because I knew they knew the stakes. They would not have come anywhere near here had they had the slightest doubt that that was safe. I had to ask. Even knowing that if they had failed, the warehouse would be buried in graze already. "We were ready to deal with the crows."
"All but one,"
One-Eye grumbled.
"What?"
"I saw a white one up there. It didn't try to follow us, though."
Once again, Sarah and I exchanged glances. Sarah said, "I'm going to change and relax and get something to eat. Let's meet in an hour. If you could find it in your heart, Goblin, you might try to get Mergen back here."
"You're the necromancer.
You're the one who claimed he anchored him. 1 hour." Goblin began grumbling to himself. One-Eye chuckled and made no offer to help. He asked me,
"You ready to kill your librarian yet?"
I did not tell him so, but I was slightly more open to the suggestion tonight. Surendranath Centaraxita seemed to suspect that Dorby Day Banerjee was something more than he pretended. Or maybe I was just paranoid enough to hear things Centaraxita never intended to say. "You don't worry about Master Centaraxita. He's being very good to me. Today he told me I can look at any book I want, unless it's in the restricted stacks."
"Ooh," One-Eye breathed. "Somebody finally found the way to her heart. Who'd have thunk a book would do it? Name the first one after me, little girl."
I waved a fist under his nose.
"I'd knock out your last tooth and call you mushy. But I was brought up to respect my elders, even if they're rambling, demented, and senile."
For all its one true God focus, my religion contains a strong taint of ancestor worship. Every Vedna believes his forefathers can hear his prayers and can intercede with God and his saints, if he feels he has been properly treated. I'm going to follow Sarah's example.
"You holler if you want to get in practice for your new boyfriend."
His cackle ended abruptly as Goda limped around me. When I glanced back, One-Eye appeared to be sound asleep again. Must have been some other old fool running his mouth. During the siege of Jaikur, I announced that never again would I be picky about what I ate. That I would respond to anything offered me with a smile of gratitude and a spoken thank you. But time has a way of wearing away at such vows. I was nearly as sick of rice and smoked fish as Goblin and One-Eye were.
breaking the tedium with the occasional supper of rice and fish meal, did not seem to help. I am confident that it is their diet that makes the Nuang Bo such humorless people. I ran into Sarah, who had bathed and let her hair down and relaxed, looking a decade younger, so that it was easy to see how, a decade earlier still, she could have been every young man's fantasy. I still have a little money I took off somebody who picked the wrong side down south, I told her, waving a tiny piece of fish caught between two bamboo chopsticks. Nuang Bo refused to adopt innovative utensils that have been in common use amongst everyone else in this part of the world for centuries. Those who did the cooking in Do Trang's complex were all Nuang Bo. What? Sara was completely baffled. I'll give it up. If we can buy a pig with it. Vedna are not supposed to eat pork. But I made the mistake of being born female, so I probably do not have a seat reserved in paradise anyway. Or anything else that doesn't go through the water like this. I made a wiggly motion with one hand. Sara did not understand. Food was a matter of indifference to her. So long as she got some, fish and rice forever were perfectly fine. And she was probably right. There are plenty of people out there who have to eat chatu because they cannot afford rice, and others cannot afford any food at all, though Soulcatcher seemed to be thinning those out now. Sara started to tell me something about a rumor that another Bodhi disciple was going to present himself at the entrance to the palace and demand an audience with the Radisha. But we were approaching the lighted area where we worked our wickednesses of evenings, and she saw something there that made her stop. I started to say, "Then we need to get somebody next to him." Sara growled, "What the hell is he doing here?" I saw it now. Uncle Doge was back, probably determined to invite himself into our lives again. His timing seemed interesting and suspect. I also found it interesting that Sara spoke Taglian when she was stressed. She had some definite points of contention with her own people, though around the warehouse nobody used Nuang Bo except Mother Goda, who did so only to remain a pain. Uncle Doge was a wide little man who, though on the brink of 70, was mostly muscle and gristle, and in recent years, bad temper. He carried a long, slightly curved sword he called Ashwand. Ashwand was his soul. He had told me so. He was some sort of priest, but would not bother to explain. His religion involved martial arts and holy swords, though. He was nobody's uncle in reality. Uncle was a title of respect among Nuang Bo, and they all seemed to consider Doge a man worthy of the greatest respect. Uncle Doge has meandered in and out of our lives since the siege of Jaikur, always more distraction than contribution. He could be underfoot for years at a stretch, then would disappear for weeks or months or years. This latest time, he had been out of the way for more than a year. When he did turn up, he never bothered reporting what he had been doing or where he had been, but judging from Mergen's observations and my own, he was still searching for his key diligently. Curious, him materializing so suddenly after my epiphany. I asked Sara, "Did your mother happen to leave the warehouse today?" That question occurred to me, too. It might be worth pursuit. Very little warmth existed between mother and daughter. Mergen was not the cause, but absolutely had become the symbol. Uncle Doge was supposed to be a minor wizard. I never saw any evidence to support that, other than his uncanny skill with Ashwand. He was old and his joints were getting stiff. His reflexes were fading. But I could not think of anyone who would remotely be his match. Nor have I ever heard of anyone else dedicating his life to a piece of steel the way he has. Maybe I did have evidence of his being a wizard, I reflected. He never had any trouble getting through the mazes Goblin and One Eye had created to save us the embarrassment of unexpected walk-ins. Those two ought to tie him down till he explained how he did that. I asked Sara, "How do you want to handle this?" Her voice was edged with flint. Far as I'm concerned, we can lump him right in there with Sing and the Daughter of Night. The enemy of my enemy is my enemy, huh? I never liked Doge much. By Nguyen Bo's standards, he's a great and honorable man, a hero due great respect. And he's the embodiment of everything I find distasteful about my people. Secretive, huh? She betrayed a hint of a smile. In that, she was as guilty as any other Nguyen Bo. That's in the blood. Tobo noticed us watching and talking. He darted over. He was excited enough to forget he was a surly young man.
Mom! Uncle Doge is here!
So I see. He says what he wants this time? I touched her arm gently, cautioning her. No need to start butting heads. Doge, of course, was aware of our presence. I never saw a man so intensely aware of his environment. He might have heard every word we whispered, too. I put no store in the chance that time had weathered his sense of hearing. He gobbled rice and paid us no heed. I told Sarah, "Go say hello. I need a second to put my face on. I ought to send for the Greys. Have them raid the place. I'm too tired for this." She did not bother to keep her voice down.
Mom?
Chapter 20. I held Doge's eye. My face was cold. My voice held no emotion whatsoever as I asked,
"What is the key?"
Bound, gagged, Narayan Singh and Daughter of Night watched and waited their turn. The faintest flicker of surprise stirred in Doge's eyes. I was not the sort he expected to be a questioner. I was in character again. A borrowed one based on a gang enforcer who had offended us a few years ago, Vajra the Naga. The gang was out of business, and Vajra the Naga had gone on to a better world, but his legacy occasionally proved useful. Doge enjoyed the reasonable expectation that he would not be tortured. I had no intention of taking it that far. With him. The company's fortunes, and those of the Nguyen Bo, had become so intermingled that I could not brutalize Doge without alienating our most useful allies. Doge volunteered nothing, nor did I expect him to be any more vocal than a stone. I told him,
"We need to open the way onto the glittering plain. We know you don't have the key. We do know where to start looking for it. We'll be pleased to return it to you once we release our brothers."
I paused, giving him time to surprise me by replying. He did not.
"You are, perhaps, philosophically opposed to opening the way. We're going to disappoint you on that. The way will open. Somehow. You have only the option of participating or not participating."
Doge's eyes shifted, just for an instant. He wanted to read Sarah's stance. Hers was plain. She had a husband trapped under the glittering plain. The wishes of the lone priest of some obscure, never-explained cult carried no weight with her. Not even Bondo Trang or Kai Goda offered demonstrative support, though both would favor him mainly out of decades of inertia.
"If you don't cooperate, then we won't return the key when we're done with it. And we will determine what constitutes cooperation. The first step is to put an end to all of the normal Nguyen Bo equivocation and evasion and selective deafness."
Vajra the Naga was not a character I liked to adopt too often. A Naga was a mythical serpent being that lived beneath the earth and had no sympathy whatever for anything human. The trouble with the character was that I could slip into it like it had been tailored for me. It would take only a small emotional distortion to turn me into Vajra the Naga.
"You have something we want. A book."
I was betting a lot on my having reasoned out or intuited the course of various hidden events, based upon what I had gotten from Mergen and his annals.
It's about so by so, and this thick, bound in tan vellum. The writing inside is in an untrained hand, in language no one has spoken for 7 centuries. Specifically, it is a nearly complete copy of the first volume of the Books of the Dead. The lost sacred texts of the children of Kena. Chances are you didn't know that.
Narion and even the Daughter of Night reacted to that. I continued.
The book was stolen from the Fortress Overlook by the sorcerer called the Howler. He concealed it because he didn't want Soulcatcher to get it, nor did he want the child to have it. You either saw him hide it or stumbled onto it soon after he did. You concealed it somewhere you feel is safe, ignoring the fact that nothing can remain hidden forever. Some eyes will discover anything, eventually.
Once again I allowed Doge time for remarks. He chose to pass on the opportunity.
You have a choice in all this. I remind you, though, that you're getting old, that your chosen successor is buried under the plain with my brothers, and that you have no allies more favorable than Gota, whose enthusiasm has to be suspect at this late date. You may choose to say nothing, ever, in which case truth will follow you into the darkness. But the key will remain here, in other hands. Have you had enough to eat? Has Do Trang been a good host? Will somebody help our guest find something to drink? We shouldn't be scorned for our failures of hospitality.
You didn't get the word out of him.
One Eye complained as soon as Doge was out of earshot. I didn't expect to. I just wanted him to have something to think about. Let's talk to these two. Scoot Singh over here. Take the gag off and turn him, so he can't get cues from the girl. She was spooky. Even bound and gagged, she radiated a disturbingly potent presence. Put her in the company of people already prepared to believe that she was touched by the dark divine, and it was easy to understand why the Deceiver cult was making a comeback. Interesting, though, that was a recent phenomenon. That for a decade she and Narion had been fugitives painstakingly taking control of the few surviving Deceivers and evading the Protector's agents, and now, just as we feel we are up to tugging a few beards, they began making their survival known, too. I had no trouble seeing where the Goonie imagination would find connections and portents and wild harbingers of the Year of the Skulls.
Narion Sin, I said in my Vajra the Naga voice, you're a stubborn old man. You should have been dead long ago. Perhaps Kena does favor you, which would suggest that here in my hands is where the goddess wants you to be.
We Vedna are good at blaming everything on God. Nothing can happen that is not the will of God. Therefore, he has already measured the depth of the brown stuff and has decided to toss you in.
And these are bloody hands. Make no mistake.
Singh looked at me. He did not fear much. He did not recognize me. If our paths had crossed before, I had been too minor an annoyance for him to recall. The Daughter of Night remembered me, though. She was thinking that I was a mistake she would not be making again. I was thinking maybe she was a mistake we ought not to make, however useful a tool she might become. She almost scared Vajra the Naga, who had been too dense to comprehend fear in personal terms.
You're troubled by events, but aren't afraid. You rely upon your goddess. Good. Let me provide assurances. We won't harm you, assuming you cooperate, however much we owe you.
He did not believe a word of that, and I did not blame him.
That was the usual sort of hold-out-a-feather-of-hope a torturer used to leverage cooperation from the doomed. In this case, the pain will all be directed elsewhere. He tried to turn to look at the girl. Not just there, Narayan Singh. Not only there. Though that's where we'll start, Narayan. You have something we want. We have several things we believe to be of value to you. I'm prepared to make an exchange, sworn in the names of all our gods. Narayan had nothing to say, yet. But I began to sense that his ears might be open to the right words. The daughter of night sensed that too. She squirmed. She tried to make some kind of noise. She was going to be as stubborn and crazy as her mother and aunt. Must be the blood. Narayan Singh, in another life, you were a vegetable seller in the town called Gondwar. Every other summer, you would go off to lead your company of Tuga. Singh looked uncomfortable and puzzled. This was nothing he expected. You had a wife, Yashodhara, whom you called Lily in private. You had a daughter, Kaditya, which was maybe just a little too clever a naming. You had three sons, Valmiki, Sugriva, and Aridatha. Aridatha you've never seen because he wasn't born until after the Shadow Masters carried the able men of Gondwar off into captivity.
Narayan looked more uncomfortable and troubled than ever. His life before the coming of the Shadow Masters was a lost episode. Since his unexpected salvation, he had dedicated himself solely to his goddess and her daughter.
Those times were so unsettled that you have since proceeded on the reasonable assumption that nothing of your former life survived the coming of the Shadow Masters. But that assumption is a false one, Narayan Singh. Yashodhara bore you that third son, Aridatha, and lived to see him become a grown man. Though she endured great poverty and despair, your Lily survived until just 2 years ago.
In fact, until just after we located her. I still did not know for certain if some of my brothers had not grown overly zealous in their eagerness to locate Narayan.
Of your sons, Aridatha and Sugriva still live, as does your daughter Kaditya, though she has used the name Amba, since she learned, to her horror, that her very father was the Narayan Singh of such widespread infamy.
By stealing Lady's baby, Narayan had ensured that his name would live on amongst those of the great villains. Everyone over a certain age knew the name and a score of evil stories burdening it. The majority of them fabrications or accretions of stories, formerly attached to some other human demon whose ignominy had been nibbled up by time. I had his attention despite his determination to remain indifferent. Family is critically important to all but a handful of us.
Sugriva continues in the produce business, although his desire to escape your reputation led him first to move to Ayodhak, then to Jaipur, when the protector decided she wanted the city repopulated. He felt everyone would be strangers there, and he could create a more favorable past for himself.
Both captives noted my unfortunate use of Jaipur, which did not give them anything they could use, but which did tell them I was not Taglian. No Taglian would call that city anything but Dejagore. I continued.
Aridatha grew into a fine young man, well-formed and beautiful. He's a soldier now, a senior non-commissioned officer in one of the city battalions. His rise has been rapid. He has been noticed. There's a good chance he'll be chosen to become one of the career-commissioned officers the great general had been imposing on the army.
I fell silent. No one else spoke. Some were hearing this for the first time, though Sara and I had started looking for those people a long time ago. I got up and went out, got myself a large cup of tea.
I cannot abide the Nyungbo tea-making ceremonies. I am, of course, a barbarian in their eyes. I do not like the tiny little cups they use, either. When I have some tea, I want to get serious about it, make it strong and bitter, and toss in a glob of honey. I seated myself in front of Narayan again. No one had spoken in my absence.
So, living saint of the Stranglers, have you truly put aside all the chains of the earth? Would you like to see your Kaditya again? She was little when you left. Would you like to see your grandchildren? There are 5 of them. I can say the word, and inside a week we can have one of them here.
I sipped tea, looked Singh in the eye, and let his imagination toy with the possibilities.
But you are going to be all right, Narayan. I'm going to see to that personally.
I showed him my Vajra the Naga smile.
Will somebody show these two to their guest rooms?
That all you're going to do?
Goblin asked once they were gone. I'm going to let Singh think about the life he never lived. I'll let him think about losing what's left of that, and about losing his Messiah. When he can avoid all those tragedies, just by telling us where to find the souvenir he carried away from Soulcatcher's hideout, down by Kia Lune.
He won't take a deep breath without getting permission from the girl.
We'll see how he handles having to make his own decisions. If he stalls too long and we get pressed, you can put a glamour on me that'll make him think I'm her.
What about her?
One Eye asked.
You going to personally work on her too?
Yes. Starting right now. Put some of those choke spells on her. One on each wrist and ankle. And double them up around her neck. He had done some herding, among other things, over the years, and One Eye and Goblin, being incredibly lazy, had developed choke spells that constricted tighter and tighter as an animal moved farther away from a selected marker point. She's a resourceful woman, with a goddess on her side. I prefer to kill her and be done with it. But we won't get any help from Singh if we do. If she does manage to escape, I want complete success to be fatal. I want near success to render her unconscious from lack of air. I don't want her having regular contact with any of our people. Remember what her aunt, Soulcatcher, did to Willow Swan.
Tobo,
has Swan said anything that might interest us?
He just plays cards, Sleepy. He does talk all the time, but he never says anything. Kind of like Uncle One Eye.
Whisper.
You put him up to that, didn't you, Frog Face? Sounds like Swan to me,
I said. I shut my eyes, began massaging my brow between thumb and forefinger, trying to make Vajra the Naga go away. His reptilian lack of connection was seductive.
I'm so tired.
Then why the hell don't we all just retire?
One Eye croaked.
For a whole goddamn generation, it was the captain and his next year in Katovar shit that beat us into the ground. Now it's you two women and your holy crusade to resurrect the captured. Find yourself a guy, little girl. Spend a year screwing his brains out. We're not going to get those people out of there. Except that. Start believing that they're dead.
He sounded exactly like the traitor in my soul that whispered in my mind every night before I fell asleep. The part about accepting that the captured were never going to be coming back, anyway. I asked Sarah. Can we call up our favorite dead man? One Eye. Ask him what he thinks of our plan.
Bah! Frog Face! You deal with us. I need a little medicinal pick-me-up.
Almost smiling despite her aching joints, Goda waddled out behind One Eye. We would not see those two for a while. If we were lucky, One Eye would get drunk fast and pass out. If we were not, he would come staggering out looking to feud with Goblin, and we would have to restrain him. That could turn into an adventure.
Well, here's our prodigal. Sara finally had Murrigan back in the mist box. I told him, Tell me about the White Crow. Puzzled.
I go there sometimes. It's not voluntary.
We took Narayan Singh and the Daughter of Night out of Chor Bagan today. There was a White Crow there. You weren't here.
I wasn't there.
More puzzled, even troubled.
I don't remember being there.
I think Soulcatcher noticed it, and she knows her crows. Murrigan continued.
I wasn't there, but I remember things that happened. This can't be happening to me again.
Just calm down. Tell us what you know. Murrigan proceeded to report everything Soulcatcher said and did after she ducked our snipers. He would not tell us how he knew. I do not think he could. Sara said, She does know that we have Singh and the girl. But did she guess why? The company has an old grudge with those two. She'll need to see bodies to be convinced there was nothing more to it than that. She's still not completely satisfied that Swan is dead. A very suspicious woman to protect her. Inarion corpse would be easy, if we could make it credible. There are a million skinny, filthy little old men with green teeth out there. But we'd sure come up short on beautiful 20-year-old women with blue eyes and skin paler than ivory. The Greys will definitely become more active now, Sara said. Whatever she suspects or doesn't, the Protector wants no one going about any tricky business in her city. A point the Radisha might argue, which reminds me of something that's been knocking around the back of my head. Listen to this and tell me what you think. Chapter 21 As the Bodhi disciples made their way through the crowds, more than one onlooker reached out to slap their backs. The disciples took that with poor grace. It told them that many of the witnesses were there to be entertained. The rite proceeded as before, but more quickly, as it was evident that the Greys anticipated trouble and had instructions to head it off. The kneeling priest in orange burst into flames just as the Greys began manhandling his assistants out of the way. A gout of smoke leaped upward. A black company skull formed inside it, an evil eye seeming to stare deep into the souls of all the witnesses. A voice filled the morning.
All their days are numbered.
And the wooden curtain wall shielding the reconstruction came to life, glowing lime characters as tall as a man proclaimed,
Water sleeps, and My brother unforgiven.
They crawled slowly back and forth. Soulcatcher herself materialized on the ramparts overhead. Her rage was palpable. A second and larger cloud of smoke burst off the burning disciple. A face. The best representation of the captains that One-Eye and Goblin could manage. Told the awed and silent thousands,
Raja Dharma, the duty of kings, know you. Kingship is a trust. The king is the most exalted and conscientious servant of the people.
I began to slide away from there. This was sure to sting the protector into some impulsive and self-defeating response. Or maybe not. She did nothing obvious. Though a sudden breeze came along, it blew the smoke away. But it fanned the flames consuming the Bodhi disciple. The smell of burning flesh spread out downwind. Chapter 22 When Master Santaraksita wanted to know why I was late, I told the truth.
Another Bodhi disciple set himself on fire in front of the palace. I went to watch. I couldn't help myself. There was sorcery involved.
I described what I had seen. As so many of the actual eyewitnesses also had, Santaraksita seemed both repelled and intrigued.
What do you suppose those disciples are doing that, Durabi?
I knew why they were doing it. It took no genius to fathom their motives. Only their determination remained a puzzle.
They're trying to tell the Radisha that she's not fulfilling her obligations to the Taglian people. They consider the situation so desperate that they've chosen to send their message by a means that can't be ignored.
I, too, believe that to be the case. The question remains, what can the Radisha do? The Protector won't go away just because some people believe she's bad for Taglios.
I have a great deal to do today, Shri, and I'm starting late.
Go, go. I must assemble the Badralok.
It's possible we can present the Radisha with some means of shaking the Protector's grip. Good luck, Shri.
He would need it. Only the most outrageous good luck since the beginning of time was going to give him and his cronies the tools to undo Soulcatcher. Chances were good the Badralok had no idea how dangerous an opponent they had chosen. I dusted and mopped and checked the rodent traps, and after a while noticed that most everyone had gone away. I asked old Baladitya, the copyist, where everyone was. He told me that the other copyists had ducked out as soon as the senior librarians had gone off to their Badralok meeting. They knew that the Badralok would do nothing, but it would take them hours of grumbling and talking and arguing to get it done, so they made themselves a holiday. It was not an opportunity to be refused. I began examining books, even going so far as to penetrate the restricted stacks. Baladitya knew nothing. He could not see 3 feet in front of his face. Chapter 23 Jal Barandandi partnered Meen Subradil with a young woman named Rahini and sent them to work in the Radish's own quarters under the direction of a woman named Narita, a fat, ugly creature possessed by an inflated conception of her own importance. Narita complained to Barandandi,
I need 6 more women. I'm supposed to clean the council chamber again after I complete the royal suite.
Then I suggest you pick up a broom yourself. I'll be back in a few hours. I expect to see progress. I've given you the best workers available.
Barundandi went elsewhere to be unpleasant to someone else. The fat woman took it out on Subradil and Rahini. Subradil did not know who Narita was. The woman had not worked in the royal chambers before. As Subradil steered a mop around, she whispered,
Who is this woman who is so bitter?
She stroked her gangisha. Rahini glanced right and left,